This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
This week's Meet and Three is all about food branding and identity in 2020. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Everybody has some Goya product in their pantry. So obviously the biggest kind of loss from all of this is the students really working with a brand that they're very comfortable with, that they're very familiar with.
I'll be honest, I was completely floored. I was very surprised that a company, especially in the current climate, would backtrack out of a commitment to address issues of racism.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief with your hosts, Zara Tangora and Bobby Comporto. That was my Bobby impression. I've been working on it for 36 years, but I feel like it might still need a little bit of tinkering. Hi, everyone. How are you? Hope that you're all hanging in there. I don't know if anyone noticed, but these are strange times. Today on the show, we are joined by Jasmine Michelle. Jasmine is a chef and a writer and an amazing human. Jasmine and I connected years ago when I was going to start a blog. Remember that back in the day? A blog that really dates me. This was only 4 or 5 years ago, but with some friends, and Jasmine and I connected. She had wanted to submit some of her amazing writing, and we just kind of like stayed in contact via social media, which is maybe the only useful part of social media, is getting to meet cool people who you might have not otherwise met. And I'm so glad that we did, because she's truly like a bright ray of light, but I feel like there's no other way to describe a lot of our guests. And Jasmine shares that with everyone else that we've had on the show. Just a breath of fresh air, a good human. And the couple conversations that we've had over the years have left me with just like, I don't know, sometimes you talk to someone and you get their perspective and you just feel kind of floored by them and their candor and their demeanor and their way of being. And that's how I feel about Jasmine. So I'm really impressed and in awe of her, and just happy to know her. And she came on to talk with us about different parts of her life and growing up, in her relationship with food, her relationship with her religion and Muslim heritage growing up, and her family, and more recently about a really out of the blue crazy fire that happened in which her partner was badly, badly burned, and how Jasmine and her partner have been coping with everything that's going on in the world, in addition to this new terrible thing that happened. Luckily, Jasmine's partner is healing well and fine, but it's been a really tough time for them. So we're so honored to have Jasmine on the show. Love talking to her. It was such a blast and such a wonderful, like, beautiful, deep chat, as they all are, but they're all special and unique. So again, hope you all are hanging in there. And please check out Jasmine on Instagram at Dreamboat Cafe. And you check out this really cool space that she has been operating in North Carolina, hosting pop-ups, but so much more. But definitely check out what she's doing, and we hope you enjoy the episode as much as we did. Thanks. Bye. So we are here talking with the lovely and amazing Jasmine Michelle. Jasmine, hi.
Hi.
How are you? Jasmine's joining us from Durham, North Carolina.
Yes. Yeah, I am. I'm really excited.
Yeah, we're psyched to have you. And we were just saying before the show started that we were,
you know, this is such a great opportunity to be able to talk with people who might have not otherwise been able to join us because they're out of state or some, in some cases, out of the country. So you and I connected years ago on Instagram because I was starting a blog and we were talking about having you write for it. And it's been so cool. That's like one of the good things about social media. One of the few good things about social media is being able to connect with folks.
Is that connectiveness. Yeah. That's crazy. It was so long ago. And I feel like both of us have evolved into a million and one different projects in like the best way possible.
I think so too. So, you know, let's start there. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what kind of projects have you evolved into over the past 4 years since we first kind of connected?
Oh my gosh. I transitioned out of the pastry kitchen, which was a really big thing because I went into like the food industry being a pastry cook. And then I slowly transitioned into farming and food justice. And then I transitioned fully into a farm to table chef and kind of the whole kitchen. And I think from there, I think I have a tendency, and for a while I thought that it was a bad thing, but I am a person that I really like micro projects. Like I like doing things season by season. I like, and the commitment of doing something for years at a time is extremely daunting to me. And so, I feel like that catapulted me into different seasons of working in the kitchen and farming, and that kind of took me all over the place. And then I kind of found a home in Hawaii for a little bit, and then I started up Dreamboat, and it was just my own platform of a dining series and pop-up food projects that I was able to give my own intentions to and my own productivity and my own themes that I felt was important in the food industry.
Cool. That sounds so interesting. Yeah. Could you explain what one kind of project might be like that you had done?
Yeah. It started off with just doing, I really just wanted to do pop-up dinners, but with the Dreamboat, I wanted it to be everything I feel like in the food industry is told that isn't standard, like the way that I was raised with island foods and Indian foods and Caribbean foods. You know, when I went into the food industry and started working on the line and stuff, a lot of it was not, the standard, the Eurocentric standard that runs the industry. And I told myself that Dreamboat was going to be everything that raised me. And I really wanted to do dinners that were surrounded by kind of the Caribbean and island and Muslim pantry and palate. And that was kind of the first ones. It was taking things that I was raised with and either doing it at a farmer's market or doing pop-up dinners. And pop-up dinners were definitely the first ones. And it's the main thing that Dreamboat is. Awesome. And it's really cool. It's really cool to think about being raised in Miami and doing a pop-up dinner surrounded by that. And I tried to intersect it with something that is like palatable and healing, like some sort of nostalgic art or movie or something, but also simultaneously breathe in some sort of political issue or social injustice so that, I don't know, we're having like a very full, well-rounded, connected conversation that's kind of intersecting food and stuff. And
totally.
Yeah.
That's amazing. It's incredible. And, you know, you say micro project and I understand what you mean, but also that's like such a like a macro project in a way. It's so like all encompassing.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, where did this all begin? Right. So if you could just tell us a bit about, you know, your heritage, your upbringing, where did your love of food come from? Like, just take us there because it's an interesting and compelling story.
Yeah. I was raised in Miami, Florida, and my mom is from Guyana and my dad is from Haiti. And we're a Muslim family. We're born Muslim. So there is a big intersection of what food looked like. It was very island. It was very Miami. Miami's is infamous for being its own little country of other little countries. And so your dinners are a little bit of your homeland, but it's also a little bit of somebody else's homeland. So I was very fortunate in that way to be able to have, you know, that variety or that diversity growing up. But my whole life is food. My family's whole life is food. When we are eating, our discussion is, what are we going to eat next? Okay. And it's cool that I now get to share that in a partner with my partner, because they are exactly the same way. And I'm like, oh, good. We're connecting on that level.
Totally. It's important, right? Like when you love food, and then you, like, I've dated people who also love food, and I've dated people who, like, are not really on that level, and you can make excuses for it. Be like, oh, it's not the most, but really, when it's a deep thing for you, it is really, when you find someone who shares that, it feels different, right?
It's very deep. I mean, we were having dinner the other night, and they just mentioned, so what are we going to have for dinner? And I was just like, oh, what? It's usually me that's saying that.
Yeah.
That's my whole family is surrounded by food. And growing up, it's weird because it's this very hetero, very sexist kind of conditioning that that lured me into my love for food and the food industry, because I was raised, the women in my family are raised to be a wife and to be a mother and to take care of the men and children. And that was my contribution. It was always, what can I do to help in the kitchen? Being as young as I was, that was my only contribution. And it was part of the conditioning as to what is a good Muslim woman? What does a good West Indian Muslim woman look like? And it is definitely to be a caterer to the men and the children in your life. And
totally.
And that education is like, it's right there, if not a little bit above, of my education of an institution of going to a culinary school, because it's just so embedded in me. But also, food was also my ticket away from that conditioning, if that makes sense. It was a way for me to find my own tradition and to travel and to see the same structures differently in different parts of the world and different parts of, you know, different lands and things. I ended up doing a lot of seasons in New England, and and I ended up always putting myself in situation where I was always the token person of color.
Right.
And at
first
it was kind of funny, and it was, you know, it's always comedic and humorous in a way, but after like the 10th place you're going to for a season, which my place was an island off the coast of Maine, which was such a beautiful experience. Every experience is beautiful, but it ended up being the most draining my spirit had felt. And I just was not feeling okay. And I was tired of being that. I don't know. I was just very tired of...
it's a big ask, I would assume, right?
Yeah.
It's a big ask that I think white people don't realize and don't push themselves to realize or think about what an ass that is for to have someone be the token, like the token person of color in a situation. And you know whether it's even well intended as, oh, I would like to like learn from you or your culture, you know, it's a lot of taking and not a lot of giving back on the part of like the white folks who are surrounding you, I would think. Is that accurate at all?
It is, and it's more than anything, it really is funny, because after a while, you really are this person that many people come up to when you are in that situation, and it's just very comical things. Like, I don't know, the shit that's been told to me is really funny. It's really, really funny.
Like, and what? Like, do you have anything?
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, the first time I was in Maine, one of the servers, I guess, was trying to be, you know, funny, or not funny, but like, you know, extend a bridge of communication, or at least like show that they are woke in some type of way, or educated in that some type of way. And there's this huge, in the main dining hall, there's a huge like armoire kind of cupboard, and I forgot what it is now. I mean, but there's a word for it, and she said, you know, go get the spoons from such and such cupboard. But there's a specific word for it that leaves me now. Right. And she looked at me and she's just like, oh, it's like an old white people thing. Like, you won't know. Like it's like an old rich white people thing. And then in the same breath, she asked me if I, she said that her sister really likes Solange's new album. Like, in the it was just in the same breath. And I was just like, that's so much to take in. And it's so hilarious. And I know it's going to impact me probably negatively, but not until I fully ingest it. Right now, it's just very funny.
Right. Well, it's like, you know, it's the defense mechanisms. I think that folks have to, you know, I notice it as, you know, just as a woman, the things that men will say to me that make me terribly uncomfortable, that then I have to process. I have to initially laugh because I'm not wanting to make them feel uncomfortable. It's such a, you bear the burden of not wanting to make the other person uncomfortable, because, you know, in this situation, it sounds like their intention wasn't like horrifying, but the what they say, it does have an impact. And so I would imagine, and I don't want to speak for you, but I'm just interpreting what you're saying as being like, it's a lot of fucking work all the time, like, to just have to manage other people's fucking experience and their uncomfortableness, because they're, you know what I mean? Is that accurate? Is it like the heavy lifting of that?
It's completely accurate. And I think what makes me think about its impact is, and not just on me, but I realize, and this is me segueing into another story, but in that same kitchen, there was, I was coming into the walk-in, and one of the younger boys who was working on the line next to me, he was like 18 years old, he was extremely young, and he's just like, Jazz, can I ask you a question? And I'm like, yeah, for sure. And he's just like, do you like to be referred to as like a colored person? Or like, I was just like, what? And it was just so random. And that wasn't even it. I was just like, I'm a person of color. I was just like, you, that's like some real 60s language saying a colored person. And I was just like, yeah, a person of color. And I'm like, why do you ask? And it was because he said that I was referred to by the chef whose little youngest daughter was in the kitchen, and I suppose somebody said, give this to Jasmine, and the youngest daughter of the chef was just like, oh, who's Jasmine? And the chef said, the black one. Yeah. And at first, when this young guy who's one of the line cooks, when he told me the story, I was just like, yeah, it's fine. And I went into the walk-in and I was just like, yeah, it's fine to call me the black person. And then for some reason, it just hit me in the walk-in, and it was like I busted the door in like a bride on fire. And I was just like, no, that's not okay. I was just like, dude, you get to be called by your name, the kid, your name with the baseball cap, and everyone else gets to have that. But I'm like, this young child was told that Jasmine is just the black person. And I'm like, God forbid, I don't know what she's going to learn about black people that there is going to be associated with me. It's not going to be the way that I laugh or something that I say or my curly hair. It's not going to be any of that. It's going to be the black person and anything else this child who's going to absorb anything from the outside world is going to learn. And it's just one of those weird, you know, I don't have many of those experiences, thank God. Most of them are just funny and then impacts you later. But that was one of the times where I was just like, wow, that can actually change, you know, the
degree. It was a microcosm of the rest of the world, right?
Right.
And incredibly reductive. at its best, reductive. And you know what I mean? And it's so I wanna just kind of circle back just for a minute to what we were talking about earlier, because you made some such interesting points when describing your heritage and growing up, and I just have a question about, like, you know, you're talking about growing up with like strong Muslim traditions and at the same time not favoring like these really intense patriarchal ideals. And yet those in some way being entwined with food, like feeding the husband, feeding the man. Is that, am I hearing that correctly? So how do you untangle those things and still be able to, like, you know what I mean? Like, what was it for you? What gave you that ability, passion, knowledge, like fortitude? Like, what were the things that like really were the fork in the road there in untangling the patriarchal values of your heritage and your love for food?
It's weird. I think it's a process that I still am in, and I think I'm going to be in it for a while until, you know, it's until you completely undo any unhealthy, almost traumatic conditioning that you went through as a kid. I realized that's just with you forever. You're going to have to, it's a conscious choice that you're going to have to make, I realize. But it got to a point where it was either I had to choose what, I had to choose myself being made up by something else, or choosing my own life, and how that, how did that look? And it looked very queer. It looked very intersected. It looked very spiritual. And I am also very fortunate to have two parents that, we are extremely traditional, but my parents are like the quote unquote liberal people of the bunch who are not the, kind of stereotypical, very strict, well, on the scale of like very strict parents, you kind of have, you know, very strict, dangerous parents. And my family was kind of like in the middle of, you know, we're strict, right. Very strict, but not that strict kind of right. thing. And so I had a very liberal mom and a mother who was very opinionated and liked to wear her makeup and liked to wear her pencil skirts, and nobody can tell her how to do certain things and wear certain things and speak in a certain way. And so she serves as an example for that, because I feel like I'm very much like that now. But also she is a woman who, you know, holds religion very, you know, the tell-all be-all of something. And my dad was the person who converted, and he's extremely spiritual, and he's very into being metaphysical. And so I'm very fortunate to have had a wacky balance of religion and spirituality, and being able to kind of see that they were both this blurred line, and that I was able to flow into my own kind of decorum and my own tradition, which I'm still discovering now.
Yeah. Can I address something that you said before? You know, you were kind of talking about introjects, which means that children growing up take in whole things that they hear, both from their family, from their religion, from their culture, from their society, you know. Mm-hmm. And then as we get older, we have this chance to look at it and say, is this right for me? Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. And then we have this chance to kind of like spit out some of it, take in some of it. But you're right, it lasts forever in a way. Some of those things are so internalized, and it really requires us to be mindful and notice when those negative beliefs come up and say, that's not true, that's not me. You know, so it'll still pass by our thinking, but it's not something we're going to believe anymore. But it's a hard job. It's what we have to do. And most of the family ones we're familiar with, like anybody that's been in therapy, they know we have to deal with things they learned in their family that weren't true about themselves, and things that they interpreted that weren't true. So I think you made a really good point.
I think so, too. And, you know, it's a term that a lot of us are using more, and you're hearing more in kind of the conversations nowadays, is like unlearning, right? And Jasmine, you had mentioned that just in your kind of pre-interview chat that we had. But I think a personal, and I think people have been referring to that largely as a cultural, you know, unlearning. But like, I guess personal unlearning too. It's like the unlearning
familial,
of our own
family.
Yeah, like, you know, the own, the things that have happened in our own lives. And does that feel accurate?
Yeah, that feels completely accurate. It's funny because it's now when I'm making conscious decisions in my life, whether it be my relationship or my business or my home, I feel like I'm always in conversation of, because I am a lover of tradition. I love tradition to the point where I will call it out and see that there were many things that didn't serve as something healthy. And sometimes I sit, and again, this is a discussion that I have with my partner too. I think I'm just like, whoa, like, I can't believe I was told that.
I can't believe this is what I learned. And we like swap stories of how things could truly fuck somebody up. And carrying that into your adulthood and realizing the work, you know, you did all that work when you were younger to listen and to behave and to follow. And then you realize like, oh man, I used all that time and I'm here with like this 0-degree platform. And now I have to backtrack and unlearn a lot and carry through and preserve a lot at the same time.
Totally.
Right. What are some of the, so I'm just curious about like, actually like, the specifics are like, what were some of the foods that you grew up loving and eating that were like really specific to, you know, your culture, but also just your household and your family?
Oh my gosh. Well, Guyanese food is a tie between Indian food and Caribbean food, just because Guyana was ruled by the British. And so, and majority of the immigrants came from India and Africa. And so lots of curries, like a million and one different curries in the same way. But also I realize in both my mom and my dad's countries and many other countries, the humble like starch, the potato, the yuca, the you know, the cassava, the boniato, like all of those are definitely the staples of my, the plantain are definitely staples of my upbringing. And, and curry and roti and rice. And, that's more so Guyanese food. And then my dad's side is lots of stewed chickens and beans, lots of beans, Haitian, the Haitian diet is just like beans. On beans, ooh. On beans.
Like how prepared? Like stewed beans, or stewed.
It's stewed. It's with like fried fish. There'll be like a sauce of it. There's sauce, which is making a sauce out of beans, or you could put beans in the damn stew. There's literally like four staples of like Haitian food, and the way that it's all intersected into a billion and one different recipes. It's insane. But definitely lots of fried fish on the Haitian side and fried plantains. And I realized, like, goddamn, we fry the hell out of anything. We fry anything. We're going to fry anything. Give us a leaf, we're going to fry it. Give us a rice, we're gonna fry it.
What do you fry it in? What kind of oil? What kind of fat?
Oh my gosh, I mean, vegetable oil for sure, but a lot of people use the fats from, I mean, we weren't a family that ate pork, but a lot of people would like sear their pork and use that fat to fry something else.
Right, yum.
And so, also use that pork, like after like any bones or little bits would also go into making rice, which is after a while, because there's a Haitian restaurant in Florida that we always got their beans and rice from, and we would just get beans and rice. And it was by far, to this day, the best beans and rice that I've ever had. And then we realized that they use like all the pork fat, all the pork drippings, like anything. And we're like, damn, that's why it was so good.
Yeah. That's amazing. I'm actually like really, really hungry right now. And I'm feeling like the full on like drooling about to happen. That sounds amazing. I want to talk a little bit about a kind of acute crisis that you're have been experiencing right now, that we chatted about a bit about the other day. But so a couple of weeks ago, about 3 weeks ago, right, there was a fire in your house?
Yes. It's so dramatic that it's almost comical. And I get to say it because we are safe and because the things that did burn were not of value or you know what I mean? It was easy to let go and all that. But I almost feel very like lavish. Like, yes, there was a fire in the house and things got out of hand, and it sounds almost regal in some way, but it was not. Funny.
In the west wing of the home, there was a fire.
In the west wing of the home, a fire broke out, and I had to get my jewels. But no, there was a fire that broke out in my room, and my partner was unfortunately sleeping and had to wake up to it and took it out, and then at the same time, all of us at some point tried to take it out, and they suffered second degree burns. And it just threw such a monkey wrench into just yet another shitty thing that's happening in many, in you know, the lives of 2020. And it's funny because yesterday, last night, it was one of the first nights that we actually had like a bit of silence, and, you know, their pain was controlled, anxiety was controlled, you know, and we started reflecting on it, and we just started asking questions like, and it's cute because my partner was just like, you know, one of these days I want to tell you the story of the fire. And I'm like, you talking about the fire that happened 2 weeks ago? And it was because it happened in two different perspectives. I was in the shower, wow. They were upstairs, and we talked about it. And it was because we were finally comfortable, because we didn't realize, though it wasn't catastrophic, it put a pattern into our daily routine, you know? Now yeah. The mornings went from that fire, waking up to a fire, to now waking up to this blistering, you know, wounds that are feel like they're continuously on fire, and it was nice to reflect, because it did throw a monkey wrench into things, and we had to change up our roles, and we had to change up things with my business with Dreamboat, and it also forced us, I think, situations like that, it also forces you to just stop and chill, and I always say, because I come from a family of caregivers, and caregiving is something that I really love to do. It's something that I take a lot of pleasure in. And I love anything that gives you an excuse to like stop, relax, or eat food, or needing to rest or take a nap. And so it was really nice to have an unfortunate situation push us into that kind of schedule, despite the pain and the trauma that's kind of laced in it.
Right, you make the best of pulling back and being together. Right.
Yeah.
Jasmine, you had talked to me last week about some of the feelings associated with what happened with your partner and their burns, and the care, and like, even though you had mentioned even then that caretaking was something you were, you know, that you liked and you were made you feel good, but also that it's been hard for you in a lot of ways. Can you talk to us a little bit about how it's been, and you know, and also, I mean, we actually talked about how it's been a grieving, like a process of grief in a lot of ways, I think, in connection with especially having to like pull back a Dreamboat and with COVID and everything happening. So yeah, can you just tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was such a, and it's nice that we're in a spot now where we can actually discuss it with almost a leveled, clear mind and me not being so overstimulated, because you do get overstimulated, and it's extremely difficult to be in a situation and see that at some point you can't help your person, you can't help your loved one, and you really just have to be there and share and try in some sense to share the burden of what they may be feeling. And a big thing, especially specifically about burns too, they say that like alongside excruciating pain, like your world and your anxiety and your energy is just, it's flipped, and you have to do that work simultaneously. And
it's a panic.
It's a panic, really. And I think there is an aspect that really hurt, thinking that in situations I always want my mom, and she's the number one person. Everything I learned about caretaking and caring for somebody and cooking, I learned from her, and she learned from her mom. But because we are in a very delicate situation where, though she knows of my queerness, isn't fully accepting of it, we couldn't, you know, I couldn't get that that treatment, and my partner couldn't get that help, and it was a barrier, and it was something that we couldn't get, and there is an immense amount of grief for what you lack, and for what you're not given the opportunity to even obtain, I think. And I think it pushed us together even more, and it made communication even stronger, and it made just transparency even more, And yeah, it's extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult to see. And also, a side note, having a situation like this, and especially with COVID happening and the civil rights movement that's happening, and being exposed to the medical industry and seeing a lot of things, you realize, like, oh man, there's so much fucked up things happening. There's so much, like, there's a tub of burn cream that you have to use an excessive amount, and it's like $700 without Holy insurance. Shit. And so it makes me think, like, gosh, how do people obtain resources to heal?
Yeah,
and
they don't, a lot of right, the times. They
right,
just don't.
They don't. And having, where do people get help and or feel witnessed or feel like they're listened to? And we're both very empathetic people, and we're very attached to those feelings of the world and that what people carry. And so I feel like we were also carrying that when seeing that, because, you know, when you're in like a really shitty situation and you're just like, you know, things could be worse. We saw that things were clearly worse for a lot of other people. Yeah. And it puts things into perspective, and, you know, it adds another kind of hurt and pain to your process.
So you felt your pain and the pain of the human condition right now.
Right. Just, right. Really.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Burn cream should never cost $700. It should never be. You know what I mean? Do you have $700? Right. No. Well, good luck suffering through your excruciating pain. Right. And realizing that, and I can really relate to you in this way without, you know, getting too political, not because I don't want to get political, just because
we won't stop.
We'll talk for 3 hours.
It's gonna be 5 hours.
You know, but it is painful, and I've been feeling that same experience too. You know, my dad passed away a couple years ago, and he had been living just surviving off of Social Security and food stamps, and mm-hmm. had been told that if he lost his grant for his chemo, he would just have to die. So I'm, you know, very aware of the importance of that. And in seeing in this crisis, particularly with coronavirus happening, and seeing how many people are, you know, just like, okay, so you spent 4 weeks in the hospital and you have a hole in your heart now. Well, good luck. Here's a $2 million hospital bill. And stuff like that. But see, and what you're talking about, like your partner, like having to pay $700 for burn cream, and you, when it hits, I think here's the thing, when we live in a way that we have to live kind of to get through the day, but unfortunately it detaches us from our empathetic selves, where we have to mm-hmm. just be like, wow, bad things happen to other people. And that's so sad, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we deeply had that empathy towards everyone whose situation was so bad every day, you know, mm-hmm. in 100%, you almost wouldn't be able to get out of bed. Like, so I understand why people are unempathetic sometimes, because it's almost like you have to be or you can't live, right?
Right, right, right. It's debilitating.
It's debilitating, but we all need more of it to, you know. But what my point is, I guess, is that when you really do, when you are really touched by how brutalizing the healthcare system is and how fucked up it is, and mm-hmm. how when something bad happens to you, if you're not rich or, you know, worse, if you're poor, you know, or mm-hmm. if you're in any number of unemployed or any number of situations that happen to folks, you're fucked. And that's and that's grief. When you realize that that happens to your fellow people in your country or in your world, like, it is it's heartbreaking, for real.
Yeah.
It's fucked up. And then you look and see that, like, not a lot of people seem to care that that happens. And
It's extremely painful. And it's funny, because I actually think of you, and since we did talk last week, it made me think, and you brought up your dad, and that was another aspect that I thought of. I thought about you and how you probably have that constant reminder, especially during COVID. And I can't imagine how triggering that is for people that have had the loss of a loved one, or had to deal with the tragedy of a loved one, or deal with an accident of a loved one, and have the constant reminder of how shitty the situation was and is, and the lack of empathy or just of anger. And it's funny, because I had this thought yesterday, because I try to stay clear from the news to an extent where I'm not getting sucked in for hours and hours at a time, but I try to know the gist of what's been happening and the recent events. And And it's really big because in the trans community, there was an attack on three very well-known trans people, and yeah. just the lack of empathy that happened there. But then yesterday, I saw that there was an incident that happened with a black man on Maui, and how his death, like, he was found hanging from his front porch, and there's been no horrible news coverage. And because I feel so connected to Maui and because I had lived there, I was angered because there were so many similarities in his stories that I felt like I had experienced myself with not the native or indigenous people there, but more so the white people that had land there and
in Maui.
That you lived off of there on Maui. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had that same thought that you had, like, how are you not so angry where you're not sleeping at night? How is nobody else? How is nobody as pissed off as I am? And I was just like, well, because it's debilitating.
Yeah.
Clearly. Like, it's, and I see why people don't even want to, like, get near it in some sense.
It's hard. I think what we need to do as a society, if I may, it's just my one person's opinion, but, like, combine, go halfway, right? Like, we know that we can't, we have to all live, right? We have to function and live and do our thing and enjoy our lives. But I think that we have to move at least 50% further empathy-wise. You know what I mean? And I think empathy is really key, right? And it's finding a real balance between understanding that, like, our time is short and it is okay to spend time enjoying the life you have. But then also just, like, really feeling, like, you know, that's a thing. And, like, I guess it just really, it did trigger me when you were talking about the $700 burn cream, because it's like, it goes so much further. It's like the lack of being able to really understand what those things feel like for folks, what it really feels like to be a black person in America and see news stories all the time about people found hanging. What it really feels like to go to not go to the doctor, even though you feel like you have a lump in your breast because you can't afford it. Like, to just even spend 30 seconds a day really fucking thinking about what that feels like, I think that can change the course of how we actually do fucking business in this world.
Well, I think what you're talking about, you know, there's many people that have compassion and empathy for their families, right? For themselves, if somebody in their family is sick, but you're talking about a more universal compassion for people that you don't know, that you don't see, and it's that to really still have that too is a very powerful thing.
Yeah, it's like feeling it in your, it's like reading a news headline and letting it go in and out of your brain and observing that that is unfair is one thing, but that is just, it's surface. It's right here, right? We all stop there. Not, you know, myself included, we all stop there often. But, like, we have to get a little bit into dirtier. The global, well, we're talking about grief. Yeah, into what grief feels like for other people,
a
right?
lot of people yeah. do not want not a lot of people, everyone, they a lot of people do not want to feel grief or they don't want to feel pain because it comes with this guilt. It now reconstructs how you are seeing the entirety of yourself and your life and your upbringing and your roots and your heritage, and it makes it seem as though you now have to claim responsibility for all of it, and the person and a person gets very overwhelmed by it, and so it's easier to denounce it or to just, you know, post a hashtag or something than to actually get nitty gritty about it. And it's funny because I discuss this a lot with anybody who would listen I just had this conversation with my partner, is having when you live specifically living on Maui or living on any native land or on indigenous land or anything like that, that was colonized, and not being of that that culture or of that blood and taking up space on that land, we both have come to realize that there's a certain bit of delusion that you have to be in. You have to be self-deluded in a way to continue living in this paradise that is kind of laced with so much tragedy and colonization and blood and lack of preservation and lack of sovereignty and And I almost get angry at, like, the folks that, you know, dear friends of mine that are still on the island. And I'm just like, you guys don't realize that's not your land. And I get, like, right. so angry, like, mad like a crab. And I'm just like, and then you realize that there's also a fatigue in that. I don't know if there's a yes. term for it, but there's a fatigue in like, being so angry that other people aren't as angry as you or totally. Wanting to move in the sense of urgency that you want to move in. And totally. And I,
a leftist fatigue.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just kidding. I said it's a leftist. It's called leftist yeah. fatigue.
Yeah.
I think it's called compassion fatigue.
Yeah. This compassion fatigue, leftist fatigue, it's just tired as hell. And I try not to, and then you end up becoming this, like, you know, to everyone else, this bitter person who's just, like, mad at the fact that, yes. you know, that you had to leave or something like that. But I left situations in places that I worked on lands that I've worked on that were indigenous and native because I felt like I couldn't feed myself and feed the land.
Right.
And feed its people. So if I'm feeling sick, I'm now just taking its resources. I'm not even giving anything at this point. And I feel like a lot of people go with that intention. I feel like a lot of people travel to India and travel to Nepal and travel to right. these impoverished or, you know, native lands that have fought so hard. You know, like, native people have fought to be beach, to just be on the beach and cruising. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, did we necessarily fight for that? But we're all out here on your land cruising for a bruising. Totally. And if that makes any sense. And so it makes me feel like I need to really, like, scream at the people that aren't of the land to be like, you better be doing work if you're totally. Here. And your work is going to look a lot different than native people's work. You know, it's going to almost look a lot more. They can sit. They can be on the beach. They can right. cruise all day if they want. But you're here on this native sacred land. You should be doing something for the space that you're taking up.
Right. Well, I think that there's... I think one of the really important things to consider, and I've been considering this a lot myself, particularly mm-hmm. in the past 6 months, about when you do go somewhere or you do like something from a certain culture. You know, I've been thinking in terms of my own person of, like, you know, appreciating and loving Black music and culture. Mm-hmm. But, like, what do mm-hmm. I give back? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it sounds mm-hmm. like you're saying the same thing about being on the indigenous land in Hawaii. Like, it's not about not ever going to Hawaii, but, like, what in turn are you giving back, right? So, like, it's just about what I'm hearing you saying, what I feel like I can connect in that is about, like, not just taking, right? Like, I think we're conditioned a lot to just take.
Right.
Definitely as white people, we're conditioned to just take. So I think, like, the really focusing on if we do, you know, take beauty or enjoy resources from a certain place or a certain culture, mm-hmm. like, be sure to keep it in your fucking brain box to, like, to give back.
Right. Like, what is your contribution for extraction? What exactly? Yes. Because that's exactly what we're doing.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about, too, when you were talking about being caring for your partner now and being in the situation mm-hmm. where your partner has burns and, you know, the kind of crossroads of that with, you know, your mom being a nurturer and having taught you to be a nurturer, but not being able to really get that from her during this point because she doesn't approve of your queerness fully, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it just occurred to me you're saying that, and mom, I'm curious to just hear your opinion on this too, being that, you know, we are mother-daughter, and I think we're conditioned to think with our parents in an ideal situation that you receive unconditional love. Right. And it can always feel like such a spur and such, like, a jagged edge, I think, when you feel like it becomes conditional in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Is
mm-hmm.
that, how, what do you think about that? I mean, like, being queer and having your mother not fully accept you, does it feel like then the love becomes conditional?
Yeah, it's funny because I realized that that's one of the things that I've realized I've had to unlearn is the conditioned love and realizing that a lot of that went into our childhoods. A lot of that went into my childhood, that this unyielding love, it's never going to end. It's never going to, you know, it's always going to be there and it's always going to be abundant, but it is going to be railed in at certain points because there are conditions to it, even if they're subtle or micro in some sense. And I mean, I don't know if there's like a clinical term for it, Bobby, but I just know that it's like, it's weird. It's, and I told my mom, because at a certain point I said, because we're always talking, we're always, you know, I'll go and see her and stuff. But yeah, at a certain point, I was just like, Mom, this isn't really healthy for me. I can't. Mm. I love you deeply and dearly, and the same way I know you love me, but I can't continue coming here and acting as if, like, you know, I have to do a lot to not, I have to drop a lot at your door, and you don't have to do that with me. And it's extremely difficult, and it is one of those things where our intersection of it is food, because a lot of the things that, you know, a West Indian mom is always going to cook for the household, and she's always going to send us food, and so even without acknowledging, you know, your queerness and whatnot, she is still trying to give you nourishment and still cares in some way, even if it hurts on your end. But yeah, it's difficult. It's a mind fuck. It really is a mind fuck. It's very hard to wrap your mind around.
Well, my only comment to it would be right now is that I think that relationships are a process. So there's some hope in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's an interchange. The process doesn't shift anything because there's a rigidity and a closed-mindedness and for different reasons. But, you know, basically when people love each other, there's a give and take, and it's an ongoing process, and people change and shift. And so that's, I don't have a technical term for it, but that's what comes up in my mind.
Yeah. Right. I appreciate it.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their bright red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile make them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
So Jasmine, kind of towards the end of each of these episodes, we ask our guests what if they could have told themselves at something at the beginning of this process, advice to get through a difficult situation, whatever it may be. And for you, it sounds like, you know, I know that the situation with your partner and the fire was really intense and that it's like drained you a lot personally. So what would your advice to yourself be at the beginning of this a couple weeks ago when you were first embarking on this, before any, you know, and if you could go back and tell yourself?
Oh my gosh, it feels like we were just asking each other those questions yesterday too. I really feel like I would tell myself, like, bitch, hold on. and remember to breathe. That's a big aspect of myself, because I'm somebody that I would do everything in one inhale and I would try to get it all done. And I realize in when you're put in certain situations, like how we're put in or anything, it will take your breath away, and you have to keep your breath really strong.
That's the spiritually, panic, right?
Yeah. Physically and spiritually. I feel like I would just remind myself to keep my breath really strong, and for myself and for my partner and for whatever else we were feeling and whatever else was kind of coming towards us, because I see now that that's what we were hanging on to. It was just our breath and our exhale.
Because the breath keeps you grounded. It keeps you in this moment. And often with panic, we're way ahead. We're in many moments. than we really need to be in this moment. So it brings the breath brings you back.
Totally. What kind of things have you been making for your partner? Like, have you been cooking for them to offer some healing vibes during this time? Are they able to eat kind of normally? Or
yeah, I mean, both of us, the first, we are just now getting an appetite back. And I feel like it came like full-fledged. Anything that's like around us, we've been eating. So I'm very happy about that. I'm very happy that my partner is actually in the kitchen cooking, being like, I'm going to cook. We're going to slowly. And so we've been having a lot of bone broths.
Nice.
A lot of bone broths, just because it's something that is palatable at the moment and we can still kind of sip it throughout any sort of sway of our day. If you know, because things can be intense, and if they're changing bandages and you know, there's different levels, and bone broth has really been helping us. And they made it's so crazy. They actually made this sauce that was insane, and it was made with a little bit of beef bone marrow and like chicken fat and like lemon juice, and it was like a pan sauce from a roast, and we put it over like roasted Brussels sprouts. And so it feels like we're just getting an appetite back for, you know, the little things in food that really bring us a lot of pleasure. But honestly, in the midst of it, It was just like, if you could get a banana for some potassium, and if you could get water, that's all I care about right now. We just need to have as much water in our bodies as possible. Totally. And I'm definitely that. I feel like when I become a mom, I'm going to be like that too. Like, just get your water in, get your water in.
Totally. Well, Jasmine, it was so nice to talk to you. And I'm just so glad that, like, you know, I feel like sometimes you just make these connections and they do endure, and you touch base with folks throughout the years just because there was something special there, and you're a very special human, and I'm really glad we got a chance to connect again.
I'm so stoked that we're able to see something so special, that we're able to see it through.
Totally.
And I'm just so happy to meet you, Miss Bobby. I feel like you should have like a master class or something.
I know, Bobby, you're the best.
Life is
Bobby.
The master class.
That's a really amazing quote, Bobby. Life is the master class. Jasmine, is there anything that you'd like to tell our listeners about how they can kind of follow what you're doing and connect with you?
Yeah. Dream Book Cafe runs predominantly on Instagram, and though we are taking a break, we have a GoFundMe up just to keep things going, and that's also on our Instagram, and it's just at Dream Book Cafe. Cool. And that's where all of our updates are at, and all of our thoughts as well about the world.
Awesome. Well, I hope when Dream Book gets back up and running, and guys, please go ahead and donate to that GoFundMe. We definitely will. We would love to be able to get this sounds of the things that you make and eat and cook. I'm like, I just want some like plantains and some delicious rice and like a curry.
Just something fried.
Woo, that sounds so fucking good right now. Like, I'm so hungry. I know.
I am too.
But I can eat fried.
Well, you guys go feed yourselves.
I know. Thank you guys
so much.
It was
really nice to talk to you. And we're sending a lot of love and well wishes to your partner and hoping that they get better.
Absolutely.
I'll send it their way.
Yeah, being burned is a really intense thing. And it was interesting when we were talking about it being, you know, mom, you mentioned panic and fright. Like, you know, the trauma from an accident also, I think, just like briefly to note, like, it shakes your perception of your just general safety in the world, right? You're like, oh shit. Like, you know, again, with me, we always hear that things happen to other people, but when something like that happens to you, it's like a real, I don't know. Yeah. It's like a real shakeup. It's like life takes you as like a grr. And that takes a lot to unwind.
And it requires a lot of grounding and soothing. So I wish you both that.
Lots of grounding and soothing. I take it.
Yeah. It was nice to talk to you, Jasmine. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Yes, so soon.
Okay, bye.
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 Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.